Gardena, California. UC San Diego Athletics presents TritonCast, the podcast for the UC San Diego Tritons. Here are your hosts, Jeff Toriel and Jenny Stevens.
Welcome to episode 52 of TritonCast, the podcast for UC San Diego Athletics. I'm Jeff Toriel. Jenny Stevens is on assignment. Whether you found us on your favorite podcast platform or on UCSDTritons.com, we're so happy that you joined us this week. Coming up in today's Triton Spotlight, we'll chat with UC San Diego women's basketball alumna Shaundine Armeo. The 2019 grad made her way to La Jolla from the small town of Winslow, Arizona. We'll learn all about her upbringing as a member of the Navajo tribe and the phenomenon known as Res Ball. She'll also reflect on her time as a Triton and tell us about the work she's doing now to improve tribal access to healthcare. Our conversation with Shaundine Armeo comes your way shortly in today's Triton Spotlight. But first, we go around campus. Although summer just arrived, fall sports are already on the horizon. Head over to UCSDTritons.com for a look at the 2021 schedules for the women's volleyball and men's water polo teams. Also on the site, we've got an update on baseball scholar athletes taking part in summer league action and the return of our popular Triton Tuesday and Throwback Thursday segments. Now, it's on to this week's Triton Spotlight. Here's our conversation with UC San Diego women's basketball alum, Shaundine Armeo. Shaundine, let's start by telling us how you ended up at UC San Diego.
Oh my goodness, how I ended up at UC San Diego. Well, you know, as the luck may have had it, I just happened to play in a high school basketball tournament out there. Probably starting my sophomore or junior year of high school, it was just completely random that my high school coach decided to sign up for this tournament. And we started playing out there, and I had such a great high school coach. He was so supportive and so motivated to get me playing college basketball that whenever we went out there, he made it a point to kind of go seek out the coaches and try to get them to come watch our games. Cause I never played really AAU basketball day in my life. I know that's like totally the norm, and it has been for a while now. And so these high school tournaments were kind of my only shot at exposure. And so it was really cool that my coach did that, because that really was how I ended up here. Heidi Vanderveer came over and watched one of these Winslow High School games that probably wasn't the number one priority of her day that day. But she came over and watched me and started talking to my coach at the time. And we kind of just got things going from there. I knew I wanted to play college basketball, and I had looked at some other schools. But once I really started learning more about UCSD, and obviously it's insane academics and the high level of competition and just science that was going on out here, I couldn't say no to that offer.
So beyond playing in the tournament in San Diego and happening to catch Coach Vanderveer's eye, what went into the recruiting process for you?
The recruiting process was just kind of a lot of back and forth with Heidi, getting to know her, getting to know the program and the culture there. Coming from this crazy, insane culture of res basketball in Northern Arizona, as we'll probably get into a little bit. I grew up on the edge of the Navajo Nation, and I am a member of the Navajo tribe. That culture was just so driven by like community and just caring about each other and really investing in the people around you. And I think when Heidi and I got to talking about a lot of that stuff, she knew that it was going to be important to me when I got here to have kind of a leadership role and have the ability to kind of build more of a caring culture on any basketball team that I ended up on. And so I think more than the like nitty gritty basketball stuff, just our conversations about team and commitment and investment in each other was really what kind of got me, really got me hook, line, and sinker to coming to UCSD.
And so coming from Winslow, Arizona, a very small town, to UC San Diego, which is a very big campus, what was that adjustment like for you?
Oh my gosh, that was it was such an adjustment, such a culture shock. There was like three times as many people on campus my freshman year as there was in my entire town growing up.
Wow.
So that was immediately just being so close to so many people in these small quarters, having to deal with some traffic, having to deal with just city noises all the time. There's like a biker game that drives right by ERC every night by my dorm. All of that was very, very different from growing up out in the middle of the desert in Winslow, Arizona. You hear some crickets at night. That's probably about it for the most part. So just the city life was a little bit of an adjustment to me. You can ask all my teammates and friends and stuff that I definitely adjusted by just taking a lot of alone time, because it just seemed like I was just around so many people all the time and things were so much more fast paced than I was used to. So there was a lot of like Sundays where that was our only off day from basketball after traveling or practicing or testing or whatever it was. And I kind of just made it my priority to have Sundays kind of to myself, just as little adventure days, whether I got a coffee at some coffee shop by myself or just went and sat at the beach. I spent a lot of time, you know, hiking around Black's Beach and Torrey Pines and stuff like that. And so I think that kind of helped me keep my sanity a little bit once I made the transition. But definitely there was a big culture shock just in terms of like playing in our arena, because we have great fans and we have wonderful fans, but I really was used to having like these huge giant filled loud arenas with just people from all over the state coming to, you know, just any measly basketball game that was going on at any point in time. So that was a little bit of adjustment too, just not having quite as much of a giant community investment all the time when I got here.
In terms of settling in on campus, was there a point maybe early on your freshman year where you had doubts that you made the right decision?
No, I don't think I ever had doubts about whether I made the right decision or not. I quickly, you know, fell in love with my team. Jolene Yang and I ended up just being, I mean, to this day, just best of friends. So having her as my peer in our freshman class, I think she helped me get through a lot of it. And just building the friendships like that, building friendships with her and my other teammates and relationships with the coaches and players on other teams and people in my dorm, and falling in love with just the education I was getting and the beautiful places I was experiencing, and especially a lot of the food. When you come to a place that has Thai food and Italian food and everything just at your disposal, it's kind of hard to be like, yeah, I made the wrong decision. Let me go back to the desert real quick. So no, I don't think there wasn't any points really where I doubted what I had made my decision. I had support coming in from all over the place.
That's super. And as far as the adventurous eating, is that how you were by nature or did that take some adjustment?
No, I think that's how I was by nature. My dad comes from a third generation Italian family. So I had been back to Philadelphia and New Jersey a lot, eating some crazy things over there once in a while. And Navajo food is traditionally maybe a little more organic than some people are used to. You got to use up all the animal there. So I think the adventurous eating was always a part of me. And coming from like so few options in Winslow, it was part of my adventurous motivation to get out there and try as much stuff as I could when I got here.
And those Shandine Sundays that you would take to yourself, did that slowly go away as you spent more time on campus, or is that something you held fast to throughout your time?
I think it's something I held fast to throughout my time. Even now, I live with my brother and I have lived together for most of the time I've been in San Diego. Even with living with him or having such a large network of like friends here now, I still kind of do that. A lot of my friends get mad at me because I'll go hiking or something and go all these beautiful places without them. And it's more understood by now that that's kind of just something that I need to reset for the week and kind of recenter whatever's going on and ground myself. That's continued on today.
That's really neat that you kind of figured that out about yourself, because not all of us can get to that point where we understand what we need to be centered and grounded. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I think that's just being outside has always been a big part of my life. My parents did a really good job of always taking me on these adventures and going really cool places. So the independence part of that is really something that I am really proud of, because I know it's hard for people to go out and do things by themselves. And I think it just gives me a really good opportunity, you know, to think and reflect and learn more about myself, because you never really know. I don't think you really know yourself unless you're really sitting and can be alone with yourself for a long time.
That's fair. I'm still learning things about myself all the time.
Yeah. And it's continuing, you know, quarantine has been a big opportunity for all of us to learn more about ourselves as we have to sit at home and figure out what to do with ourselves.
All right. We're going to come back to that positive attitude of yours, because I know you just said that quarantine is an opportunity. So we'll put that aside for a moment, but we're going to come back to that. So getting back to your time at UC San Diego, you were a human biology major in Roosevelt College. Why did you pick that major?
Well, you know, coming in, I wasn't totally sure what I wanted to do. I really had a long history of telling people I wanted to be either a veterinarian or a doctor. And my dad, I come from, I guess I would have been a fourth generation doctor. My Italian grandfather, great grandfather, and my grandfather and my dad are all physicians. And so that was kind of a motivation coming in. I wanted to kind of maybe look into that sphere of the world, and anatomy and biology and all of the clinical stuff has always really interested me. But I've kind of switched paths a little bit. I loved all of my coursework at UC San Diego, even when it was the real hard stuff, that organic chemistry and one of those animal physiology labs really tested my limits there. But I've kind of just realized and done a lot of reflecting and found that public health and kind of community health is a little bit more my sphere. I kind of like the more grassroots nature of all of this work, but I haven't totally crossed any kind of clinical work off my list.
Well, you're still young enough. You can make that change should you decide to do so at some point.
Yeah.
So on campus, though, you've got a challenging major. You're playing a sport in basketball that certainly demands a lot of your time. You were a four-time CCAA all-academic selection. How in the world did you balance that?
How in the world did I balance that? You know, it's pretty surprising to look back and reflect on that, because, you know, there was definitely a lot of times where it wasn't easy. And it's pretty insane. It doesn't feel like I was a four-time academic player all the time. But I think just the motivation behind everything of like the idea of this education is going to eventually help me serve people, serve my community. It's, you know, going to make my parents proud. I really just truly enjoyed a lot of the stuff I was doing. I'm competitive by nature. So getting in there and competing with people to get good grades, all of those factors kind of piled up together to kind of help me graduate, to help me do what I did. Not to mention that there was always a great support system built in the athletic department. Like the coaches were pretty good about, you know, keeping on top of us. If they kind of could tell that we were struggling or we were more stressed out than usual, they're pretty good about talking to us about it and help asking if we needed anything else. The basketball team was definitely a big resource in that, you know, we could kind of peer pressure each other into studying together more and like, hey, we're going to the library like all day tomorrow. Like you better be there with us and come hang out. And so all those things, I think, kind of piled in together to really help my career be what it was while I was there.
We're chatting with Shandine Armeo this week on Triton Cast. Let's talk about basketball at UC San Diego. What are some of your favorite memories from your time with the Tritons?
Wow, some of my favorite memories. There's so many. One of them that immediately comes to mind, although it wasn't our most successful campaign, my freshman year when we went to Alaska, that was so much fun. I feel like that was a big moment in my career there, just because it was kind of opening my eyes to like all the things that basketball really was opening the doors to. We were just traveling all these cool places and having so much time to bond with each other outside of basketball. We'd just gotten done with finals. We were all super, you know, stressed out and ready to just focus in on this tournament. And we all just had such a great time eating our meals together, staying in the hotels together, seeing a little bit of Anchorage together. And I think all that team building ended up helping in the tournament, although it wasn't like our most successful tournament at the time. I remember all of the passion and the feeling going into that one of the last games we played there. And it was a real heartbreaker when we lost. And I think it just made me realize like, if I can invest more and I can really just be a part of this team and do good things, that it's going to be, you know, the whole experience at UC San Diego is going to be so worth it. So that was really, really cool. Other moments, my junior year in the NCAA tournament, we were having a hard time with, I can't even remember which team it was now, Montana team. But my end of my junior season, I was kind of getting, you know, a nice streak going. I was getting a lot of playing time and I was playing really steady. And I think that period in my career was something I'm really, really proud of, because I was working really hard and I was just grinding it out to try to be there for our team and be a backup for Delana and Michaela when they were just killing it on the court. Michaela and Delana absolutely were just going at it all the time. So to be able to come in and give them some relief and be able to give our team like confidence that we had, you know, me coming off the bench, I think that that was probably one of the highlights of my career personally.
It was Montana State Billings, by the way. I looked it up.
Yes, Montana State Billings.
Your junior year, that season you're referring to, after the season, you were named the team's most improved player. What did that award mean to you?
That award meant a lot to me, because that's all based on, you know, the team voting. The coaches ask the team who they think's the most improved player. And so I think to have that kind of respect for my team, especially going into my senior year, gave me just a ton of confidence and really just kind of gave me the pat on the back that, you know, it's always nice to have after a season. I was pretty proud of myself already for just, you know, grinding it out and getting those minutes in the end of my junior season. So to have everybody else kind of acknowledge my accomplishment as well, that was just really, it's heartwarming. It's good for, it's good for all the ego and all this stuff, but it really just made me happy because I know my team loved me and it was nice to have them just kind of acknowledge that at the end of everything.
Well, to be a downer for just a quick second here, I know your senior year, you were injured and missed, it looks like, about half of the season. What happened?
Oh, yeah, that was to end my junior season so well. I guess that worked out well, because then in October of my senior season, I dislocated my knee, got it wrenched right out of place. Pretty much the most painful thing I've ever experienced. And I have a very high pain tolerance. I've been stung by stingrays twice in San Diego. And that's still just about the worst thing that's ever happened to me. So that was a pretty rough start to the senior season.
And that was in practice?
Yeah, that was just in practice.
And so you came back for the second half of the season. What was that rehab process like?
That rehab process was pretty much the most insane thing I've been through. There were points where we were doing 8 workouts a week, just kind of outside of practice to get me rehab, to get me stronger, to work on my cardio off of the floor. I was just so blown away on how much work and how much time went into that rehab process. And it is really funny because it really gave me a whole new respect for our other teammate, Layla, who just graduated this weekend, because I was doing a lot of workouts with her because she was coming back from her recent knee injury too. And I just, every day I walked in and I was like, Layla, I don't know how you have done this for so long. She had multiple knee injuries throughout her career there. And it gave us a lot of bonding time, but it just gave me a whole new respect for her and all the other athletes that go through that kind of thing. It's grueling and it's so rewarding in the end when you get to get back on the court, but you're really putting in so much more work in the weight room, outside of basketball practice. It's a test of your, really of your resilience, just because you feel very excluded. And that's nobody's fault. It's just part of it that you can't be on the court with your team in practices every day. You can't do the workouts with them every day. And there's just certain things that you miss out on and it makes it even harder, but it does give you that extra motivation to get back on the court.
And folks, that's Layla Ibarra-Harvey that Sean Dean was just referencing, who we chatted with back in episode 47 of Triton Cast. So feel free to listen to her conversation about how she rehabbed more than once. But Shandine, back to your situation, you talk about being away from the team and a lot of this is on you to put in the work. How much of a mental grind is that?
Yeah, it's definitely, it feels almost more mental than physical a lot of the time, even though sometimes you are doing multiple workouts outside of practice, doing rehab for hours at a time. The mental component of it gets really, really tough because you're just away from your team, and being kind of the leader, just the natural kind of leader and talker that I am, that was really hard because I just kind of felt like I was kind of losing my purpose, you know, because I couldn't be out there cheering people on. I couldn't be out there talking people through a play or giving them pointers or helping them out or doing whatever it is, you know, that you do out on the court with your team. And so it kind of does test your sense of self and your sense of purpose on the team. So I think in those moments, it just really was the biggest challenge was just reminding yourself that you still belong. You still deserve to be there. You still are going to get back and you're still going to be part of the team. So it definitely was harder. It didn't help that towards the middle of that, my winter quarter, I was taking some of the hardest classes I've taken at UCSD, like all at the same time on top of the workouts. So that period was really, really rough. But just with the help of Delana Sampton always being there for me and Jolene always being there for me, the coaching staff really trying to do what they could for me, it was a great time. And not a great time, but you know, I was able to get through it with a lot of support and a lot of help. And Matt Kritz actually was another person who I think really made that whole process so much easier, because that had been the only time I'd ever been able to work out with him and been coached by him. And his ability to make you just work hard and enjoy something so much, even when it's really, really a grind, he really was a big reason that I think that went so smoothly for me.
When you finally got back on the court, what was going through your mind?
I was pretty scared. I mean, it had just been such a violent injury. It was hard to imagine that I could be out there and take any kind of physical contact without breaking again. I'm still like that to this day. I've been playing a little bit more again, and I've been watching NBA basketball games, and just seeing anybody get hit and stuff now, it just makes me cringe in a way I never used to before. So it was definitely pretty scary when I set foot on the floor, but seeing the life and the hope and the joy of my teammates and my family, just knowing that I had the potential to still, you know, help my team in those moments, I think the scaredness kind of melted away after the first, you know, couple of minutes, and I just got back into the groove of things, and that competitive spirit just takes over and lets you do what you love to do. You know, the love for the game really takes over in those moments, and you just kind of forget about your fears.
Well, we're joined this week on Triton Cast by Shondeen Armeo, and let's go back to your youth. How old were you when you started playing basketball?
So that's a funny story. I can't remember exactly how old I was when I first played, but my dad always likes to come back to the point that when I played in my first City League game, I was running away from the basketball and spacing out and not paying attention. And he kind of looked over to my mom and was like, you know, she might just be a cheerleader when she grows up. It's okay. And I didn't like basketball to start. I don't know what it was back in those days, but I just liked being more of a softball player. I kind of tried soccer. I did volleyball. I did track. I did all these other things. And it wasn't probably until I was like 9 or 10 that I, you know, was ahead above all the kids on the playground all of a sudden. And I started beating up on some boys when we were playing at recess. And I was like, oh, maybe I'll try this City League thing again. And from that point on, yeah, I really just fell in love with it. It's such a culture in Northern Arizona, and we were playing it every day at lunch, and I was playing it in City League, and I started to make all these friends, and I started to, you know, really develop my skills and go home and shoot with my mom and dad on our basketball court every day at home. And I just, you know, there was no turning back at that point.
Came a long way from when you were running away from the ball.
Yeah, it takes a lot for my dad to kind of give up that quick, but it must have been pretty bad for him to be like, all right, guess she's not a basketball player.
A little bit earlier on in our conversation, you mentioned a reservation ball or res ball. What is that?
Okay. So yeah, res ball is just this insane phenomenon. I'm sure it's true on other reservations across the country. I've kind of gotten a hint of it out here in Southern California tribal communities, but in Northern Arizona, because Navajo Nation is the largest Native community in this country, like it's just, it's overwhelming. People fill arenas. People get crazy in the crowd. They get loud. They show up at 5 a.m. to reserve seats at places. It's just a huge culture. There are places on the reservation where you don't see a house for 10 miles, but when you do see a house, it has a basketball hoop on a dirt court, or somebody has some plywood up with some kind of square painted on it. It's just this thing that has invaded the culture in Navajo Nation, and people just love it. It's just a way for, I think, you know, it's just the community aspect of it, the active lifestyle part of it, the way you can play basketball, all you need is a hoop and a ball. I think when things are tough, that has been an escape for so many people out in that area. And for so many of us, it's just been such a good way to get away from the hard things and just enjoy yourself and get to know people and support people, make friends and have fun. And we're good at it. Like, there's a lot of Navajo basketball players I've seen in my life that have been so good and so fast and so passionate that, when I was in high school, we won the state championship my junior year, and the atmosphere down in Phoenix at the jobbing.com arena was pretty much the most intense thing I've ever experienced in my life. We had fans coming from all over Arizona, all over Northern Arizona. Like I said, they would show up at 5 a.m. and wait for these doors to open and put blankets down and put anything down they could think of on these seats so that they would have that gym reserved from opening until nighttime when we played for our championship. And when we won, we just had in a roaring crowd. It was just pretty much the most magical thing, like straight out of a movie I've ever experienced.
And to clarify for our listeners, that's the arena where the Coyotes NHL team plays. So that's what, 15,000-16,000 seats. That's pretty big.
That is, it's not a small arena, and it was just filled. It's filled with people. Whenever there's, it's always like a big joke that like the White Mountain teams don't get, whenever they're in the championships and stuff like that in Arizona, they don't have as many fans, because if there are any kind of tribal, like teams that have tribal members on them or like are from the res, cause there's so many good res schools, like Page, Arizona is pretty much a dynasty at this point. Window Rock, Chinle, all of the high schools out there have some really good, really great programs. And whenever there's any team with Navos in it down in jobbing.com, we're going to show up. The fan base is going to be there, and you're going to know that they're there.
That's fantastic. Maybe an unfair question, but why do you think it is that basketball caught on over the years on the reservation and maybe not other sports such as soccer that are also fairly minimalistic as far as the requirements to play?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Soccer seems like it would be more of an obvious sport out there, but I can't really be sure. I'm not some question for a history buff to go into, I think would be really cool, but I really don't have a good answer for it. Navajo people, they do a lot of running of kind of just in cultural practice. Navajos traditionally were nomadic people, so they were always very fit and into the running lifestyle. So they probably are great soccer players too. I myself, not much of a runner, don't enjoy it that much, but I just think it's the way that we can come together and we can just move our bodies and be in community. That's something that has always just been really easy for us and just kind of comes right from the culture of out of our playbook of just, you know, gathering and hanging out and having a good time. And which is crazy because these places are so isolated and sometimes just out in the middle of nowhere. And there's some arenas out on the Navajo reservation that would rival a lot of high school arenas around the country. Like you're out in Chinle, Arizona, and they have one of like the biggest, nicest arenas I've played in my life. So it's just something that, I don't know, Navajo Nation latched onto, and they really are not giving it up anytime soon.
That's wild. And so your upbringing, your father, you said he's from Philadelphia, he's Italian. Your mother's Navajo. So how did that affect the way that you were raised, being kind of some of both?
Some of both. I think it's really helped me be just very well balanced and open-minded and just kind of adaptable. I've been in and out of these two very different worlds my whole life. You know, I'm grew up in Winslow, and I spent a lot of summers going back and forth between there and, like I said, Philadelphia to visit my grandparents there. And I think seeing what people can survive on in Northern Arizona with so little and having them appreciate so much, and then seeing other people have everything they need and maybe not appreciating as much out in Philadelphia, or seeing people still struggle in Philadelphia in the city. I think just seeing that just made me, it kind of formed, you know, my empathy and my desire to help people and be, you know, not a doctor anymore, but still work in some kind of community health setting. I think that really just grew my worldview and helped me decide that I wanted to do something where I could help people no matter where they were, or what they had, or what they started with, or what their story was, that I just wanted to be there for people and be able to help.
That's a good segue into public health and the work you do now. You work as a research assistant for the Indian Health Council. What's the charge of that organization?
So this organization is really cool. It's a tribal run clinic out here in Southern California. I grew up around the Indian health system my whole life because that's what my dad is a physician for the Indian Health Service in Winslow, Arizona. So I kind of had gotten a peep into that most of my life, seeing what my dad did and hearing what he did every day at work. So to come out here and see this tribally run clinic, it makes it a little different because there's a lot more sovereignty and responsibility that the tribe is handling instead of the federal government. And so it's really cool to just see how things are running so smoothly, and people from these tribes are in charge of their healthcare. And it's amazing to see people be able to come in here and get services for little to no cost, and to be so adaptable to see a problem in the community and immediately be like, all right, we're going to get a grant and we're going to get funding and we're going to figure out how to address that problem. So it's just been really, really cool experience for me to be here and to get to know some of these Southern tribes a lot better, and definitely to be in a setting that I'm used to. San Diego definitely has a lot of different tribal members from all over. UC San Diego has their Intertribal Resource Center that really helped me get into the Native community in San Diego around my junior year. They actually were the reason I got this job. The networking I did there segued me into this clinic setting, but just to be here and to be around other Native people, whether they're Navajo or not, has been just such a great experience for me. And it has just filled my heart to be around here and be able to serve these people.
That's super and fascinating how you used the campus organization to network and end up where you are and you're comfortable and you know you can make a difference. What do you do on a daily basis in your role?
Well, that's a funny question because I started February 18th of 2020 and I had about 3 weeks, maybe 2.5 in the office before I got sent home. there was this thing called COVID, came in, sent us all home right away. So it's been such a funny experience to have, you know, be so excited about this new job and be graduating out of college and really doing this full-time thing. And then to just immediately be sent home and sitting on my couch for 3 months, just doing whatever we could do until we came back into the office around June. So it's been an interesting, really interesting time to kind of see how this clinic adjusted. They had to do so much to figure out how to still get people services and things while COVID was happening. So my job looked nothing like it was supposed to. All of the interviewing and the recruiting process and what they sold me on just did not happen for up until a month ago, really. So the first year of my job was a lot of just kind of trying to help our research team adjust our surveying, because what I'm really supposed to be doing here is going out into communities and recruiting people to participate in our research. And there were just no events. There was nowhere to go. There was nobody I could go talk to. So being the face of this study hasn't been easy, but now that things are opening up more, I've worked a couple of community events. I've gotten to do some more interviews and surveys with people. So on the daily basis, that's what it looks like, is getting out into the community. And even if we're not getting data, we're not just trying to suck data out of people, just getting to talk to people, getting to know people, getting them to just even kind of consider the things we're talking about. I work on an HIV and STI study that's coupled with the opioid abuse study. So just getting people to even kind of consider these things that we're trying to raise awareness about and help with prevention programs around the clinic, just having those conversations is what my job is really all about.
Broadly speaking, what challenges do Native Americans face in terms of accessing healthcare?
Well, I thought it was kind of an isolated thing to Navajo Nation to just have a lot of space to travel to get to these services, to have transportation issues. But as I've learned really quickly coming to this clinic, that's not an isolated situation. Of course, a lot of Native American communities aren't the most robust in terms of economic issues. So even having transportation to a clinic, having money to even get healthcare, those kind of things can be really, really hard if you're not directly next to some kind of community health place or an Indian health service kind of clinic. So those are some of the things that have really opened my eyes to how much of a widespread problem this is, even in Southern California, where everything seems to be so close and there seems to be so many services all around us. You come out here to the Valley Center area and these people live up at the top of the mountains. They live up of these crazy roads. I've driven some crazy roads up here in some crazy conditions, and they have to just go through all of that. Not to mention, you know, having childcare so you can come down here and get your services taken care of for a day. There's just so many different factors that a lot of people, I don't think, you know, especially if you're not in this kind of situation, you just don't consider that transportation would be an issue, that distance to a clinic would be an issue, that you probably are taking care of multiple children from multiple different parts of your family, or you have an elder in your house that you're taking care of and you don't have time to leave and come get your stuff taken care of. So there's a lot of different factors that I think are present here, but definitely present in a lot of different reservations throughout the country.
You're right. There are so many things that many of us take for granted about something that's seemingly so simple, like transportation, that is obviously a huge obstacle for so many.
Yeah, there is.
On top of that, the COVID-19 pandemic you referenced a moment ago, how has that affected tribal communities?
So that has affected tribal communities. It's been a very mixed bag throughout the country. I've kind of, you know, tried to keep tabs on it throughout the country. It was not so bad out here in the southern communities. This clinic serves a 9-tribe consortium, and luckily they didn't have it. They lost a lot of people, which, you know, it's heartbreaking to see the kind of lack of services, lack of awareness that happened at the start of COVID-19, just for the whole country. You know, people didn't always have the best information, and there wasn't always the ability to have the best practices, because you work in places where it's a minimum wage, or you just work in places where there's closeness to people and you don't really have a choice because you need the money. Those kinds of things definitely affected a lot of people here in these communities. But just personally, it was really, really hard to see Navajo Nation go through it so hard. It was so strange at the start of the pandemic. My dad was actually out here in San Diego visiting on March 13th when, some news kind of broke that potentially somebody on Navajo Nation had it. And my dad was getting calls about it immediately. And he was like, oh no, that it's not going to be COVID. There's no way that we're going to get COVID out in Navajo Nation this quickly. And that actually ended up kind of being around that time, patient zero for Navajo Nation. And from there, it just spiraled out of control. So, well, at the clinic here, they didn't get completely overrun and overwhelmed by the COVID cases. I did have to watch kind of in horror as my dad and Navajo Nation went through all of that early on and lost a lot more lives than I ever would have thought that they would have, being, you know, so separated and isolated out there that they are.
That's absolutely heartbreaking. In terms of the rollout of the vaccine, how has that gone?
That has been, I mean, just a huge highlight through all of this darkness. The rollout in Navajo Nation has just been so good. They have had so many vaccination done. And again, I get such a unique look into this through my dad, because he does do a lot at the clinic in Winslow. And just immediately right off the bat, the federal government and the Navajo government did a really good job of collaborating and just getting vaccines out. There were drive-throughs all day, every day, 7 days a week. They were going out to all these isolated places and offering their services and offering testing and drive-throughs, and people just out in the middle of the desert, just sitting in their cars in these long lines waiting for the vaccines. The rollout has been really great. It was a lot faster than even in San Diego. I know there's a lot more people here and things aren't quite as simple, but I was my dad and my mom were both fully vaccinated by like the start of January. All of my family back in Winslow was vaccinated before the end of January. So the rollout out there for Navajo Nation members was really, really quick. And I think not that we deserved it more than anybody else, but I think that it was really something that they should be really proud of and that we should reflect on, like as a nation, that when you have a lot of passionate people doing their jobs and stuff, that things like that need to happen more often, because it was such an insane period to be losing so many people out there, that the vaccinations really helped kind of lift everybody's spirits after that.
That's so heartwarming to hear that. And broadly speaking, in Navajo Nation, it sounds like there was widespread adoption and not necessarily resistance like we've seen in many parts of this country. Is that accurate?
Yeah, there's definitely, people that aren't all about it, and kind of, there was a lot of hesitancy at the start. And there still is. We're not a monolith and not everybody agrees on everything all the time. But I think that being that the community-based culture that we are and the like matriarchal society that we are, that the idea, the messaging kind of was like, you know, this is for our families. Like we all, there's so many people in multi-generational homes. Like if you don't do this, we're putting our whole family at risk. We're putting our whole community at risk. And we've lost enough. We've lost enough elders that have these knowledges and these stories and these things that we can't get back now. So if we continue to be hesitant and we continue to kind of not trust the science, there's a lot of reason not to trust the science, considering the history in this country with Native peoples and Western medicine. But the messaging really was that, you know, if we can just trust the science this one time, that we might be able to save the people that we love and the community that's already been hit so hard. So I think that that really, really helped us get this vaccination rate so high so quickly.
We're chatting with Shandine Armeo on TritonCast. How often do you get back to Winslow?
Much more than my dad is happy about. He hates me driving. he hates me going so far all the time. Him and my mom worry about me. But I go back pretty often. When I was in school, I was spending a lot of my summers out there still. I go back for most of the holidays when I can. Now that I'm not a student, I go back probably like once a month just to say hi to my best friends are there. My parents are there. My extended family is there. I have my grandmother's house where a lot of my cousins and aunts and grandpa still are. So I just love the pace of life there and just being able to go there and relax and unwind and be outside and, you know, see so many friendly faces. It's like, I go to the grocery store, I just go to Walmart and I run into 10 people that are asking how I am and asking how the family's doing and stuff like that. So it's definitely a place that I'm always going to go back to, and it's always going to be my home. And that life and that place and that culture is always going to be, you know, a huge part of me, even if I may not ever end up living in Winslow again.
That's really neat to hear. I want to go back to your high school playing days for just a moment. You talked about that state title your team won. Well, I know your senior year, you were the state Division III player of the year. What did that honor mean to you?
It meant a lot. You know, I was so excited to just be able to represent my community and to be able to give us something to be proud of most of the time. Like I said, the community support in Winslow was just always huge, whether it was, you know, from the Navajo Nation and the people on the reservation, or it was just, you know, everyone around town. There was so much community support. So those accolades and everything that happened in high school, like they really meant nothing to me. They just meant so much that I was able to carry that around for my town, because our little community and all the love that's there and all the support that's there, it was kind of more of a testament just to what that can produce in a small town, even if we don't have much.
And when you came to UC San Diego, we talked about the adjustment, you know, to being on a big campus and away from home and those kinds of things. But one thing we didn't touch on you were, as we just said, the state player of the year, and your team is winning state titles and so on. But here at UC San Diego, you didn't come in as a starter. In fact, you were coming in off the bench for your career. What kind of adjustment was that for you?
It was definitely a big adjustment. You know, your ego never takes those things very easily. But I think just being like the very adaptable kind of optimistic person I am, I took it in stride. I didn't expect to come in and be a superstar right off the bat. I didn't come in and expect to, you know, just dominate everyone all the time. I was pretty realistic in what it was going to be like coming here, because I knew I kind of was living in a bubble in Northern Arizona and our small little division and everything out there. I know we had won a state championship and we had kind of fallen a little flat my senior year of high school, but I was just coming here and I knew, you know, I was going to have to work hard no matter what. And having Heidi Vanderveer and the coaching staff and my teammates be so supportive and always, you know, reminding me of my potential and really just trying to motivate me to, you know, be my best. That was all easy. It was an easy adjustment for me at that point. Once I realized, like, you know, I'm not going to come in here and be the superstar scorer off the bench. Like, I want to come in here and I just want to be the gritty rebounder. I want to just play defense. I want to get stops. And seeing people like Jamie Katuna and Farrah Shakur, you know, Farrah being All-American, and then seeing Delana Sampton play too, like players like that, you know, it just made me realize, like, you know what, maybe I'm not there, but I have so many other things to offer that I'm going to work really hard to just be a rebounder and, you know, get my shots where I can, but just be a part of this team in other ways that maybe aren't going to feed my ego in the best way. But I want to be a leader. I want to be a good teammate. I want to, you know, still focus on academics, all those kinds of things kind of just piled up to make it a little easier of an adjustment than being the crazy, you know, quote unquote superstar and stuff that I was in Winslow.
And now that knee is recovered, do you still play?
I do. It was nice that COVID kind of came and it didn't, it gave me a lot of time to sit and rehab and take care of myself. And I wasn't missing out on all the games with my friends. So now that things are a little bit more opened up and I have a lot of friends that are vaccinated, we've been getting out there. Me and Jolene Yang and we have a group of guys that we met at UCSD in the rec center where we've been getting out there a little bit, and it's been really, really fun to get back to it.
What does your name mean?
My name, Shondine, means sunshine in Navajo.
That's really cool. So were you required to have this super positive personality, or did it just work out that way?
It just worked out that way. You know, I don't think my parents knew what they were getting themselves into with that name, but this is what they got.
But how have you remained so positive with all the challenges you've faced personally in terms of your injury and these adjustments? And of course, growing up in the Navajo community and the challenges that nation faces on a daily basis, and of course, on an ongoing basis, how have you stayed so positive?
I think that's just, it's just in my blood. You know, I think I just focus on the good things because I know how bad things are for other people. I know how bad things can be. And I just think that, no matter how hard things kind of get, if you can always come back to the people that love you, and you can always come back to the community that is there for you, and know that you're always going to have love to surround your people that care about you, or a home to reside in, that, you know, as long as you have those things kind of covered, that you can get through anything, and anything else is temporary, because there's always going to be these communities that have stood the test of time. And if you have their support, you're going to be all right in the end.
Powerful words indeed. Shondine, thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been so much fun.
Really, really enjoyed that conversation with Shondine. Thanks very much to her for the time and for her candor. Really enjoyed learning about her upbringing as a member of the Navajo tribe, learning all about res ball. I had no idea about that phenomenon. And also very important work that she continues to do to help with tribal access to healthcare, especially during these times. So important. Well, you won't want to miss an all-new episode of Triton Cast next week. Coming up on episode 53, We'll chat with Lucas Tager of the UC San Diego men's soccer team. We'll learn about his global upbringing and why he's spending the summer in Lebanon. New episodes of TritonCast premiere each Wednesday. Thanks so much for listening to this week's show. If you like what you heard, subscribe, rate the show, write us a brief review. Don't forget, you can find us on all your favorite podcast platforms like Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Audible, iHeartRadio, Pandora, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Verbal. For more on TritonCast, follow us on Twitter. We're at TritonCast. And if you've got suggestions for a future guest, send us a tweet or email Jenny and me. We're at TritonCast@UCSD.edu. We'll see you back here next week.
You've been listening to TritonCast. TritonCast is a production of UC San Diego Athletics Communications. Please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast on your platform of choice. If you have show questions or comments or suggestions for future guests, email us at TritonCast@UCSD.edu. You can also follow the show on Twitter at TritonCast.